We're examining tensions between North and South Korea on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump expressed openness to holding talks between the U.S. and North Korea during a call with South Korean President Moon Jae-in on Wednesday. During a conversation with reporters over the weekend at Camp David, the president said he would absolutely be open to talking to Kim Jong-un. President Trump said North and South Korea's talks about the Olympics are a start.
If I weren't involved, they wouldn't be talking about Olympics right now. They'd be doing no talking, or they would be much more serious. He knows I'm not messing around. I'm not messing around, not even a little bit, not even 1%. He understands that. At the same time, if we can come up with a very peaceful and very good solution, we're working on it with Rex, we're working on it with a lot of people. If something can happen and something can come out of those talks, that would be a great thing for all of humanity.
Lisa Collins is a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. She lived in South Korea for 10 years, where she worked at the Asian Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul. She studies U.S.-Korean relations, Northeast Asian security, nuclear proliferation, and disarmament. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
So we're looking at talks now, Winter Olympics, bringing North and South Korea together. What do we know, first of all, about how the talks went this week between North and South Korea?
So the two Koreas met a couple days ago. They met along the demilitarized zone in a special building that's set aside for talks. The two Koreas agreed that North Korea would participate in the Olympics. They also agreed that there would be family reunions between the two Koreas, which stems from the Cold War era. And then there would also be some contact between the two militaries through a hotline, which was cut off about 2 years ago when the tensions were very high on the Korean Peninsula.
This comes after months of missile tests. Do you see a thawing at all of relations? What's going on here?
So I think it's a little bit too early to say. Definitely, I think it's a first step. But we have to consider the history of the two Koreas and also the tensions that have been going on for the last several years. As you mentioned, North Korea has been testing a lot of missiles, really since Kim Jong-un, who is the current North Korean leader, has come to power. He came to power in 2012. And over the last 5 to 6 years, he's tested over 80 different types of he's tested missiles on 80 different occasions. So there's a lot of missile testing that has been going on, and the United States and South Korea, Japan, have been very concerned about the North Korean development of its missile program, ballistic missile program, and its nuclear weapons program. And having talks between the two Koreas, South Korea and North Korea, is initially a first good sign, but we don't know yet if that will lead to other progress in the area of denuclearization, which is the ultimate goal, of course, of the United States and South Korea. So we're still waiting to see what will happen.
It's been 30 years the last time the Olympics were held in South Korea in 1988 in Seoul. And after talks to co-host the games failed, North Korean agents attacked a Korean passenger plane, killing over 100 people. But it seems also that North Koreans and South Koreans have also come together over sporting events. Is North Korea's decision and South Korea's decision to participate this time a real attempt here to find common ground? What do you make of North Korea being able to be at the Winter Olympics?
So you are correct. The two Koreas have come together in the past on three different occasions, one being the Sydney Olympics, Summer Olympics in 2000, and then there were a couple of other occasions during the period of the Sunshine Policy in South Korea, which was a period when a South Korean government was more willing to engage with the North. During that time, they had some contact over sporting events, but it didn't really lead to very much progress. There were a couple of family reunion meetings, which were, of course, a very good thing for the families in North and South Korea. But other than that, sometimes the talks don't really lead to much because there's not agreement on how to address North Korea's nuclear weapons program and its development and that. So again, I think this time around, people are very optimistic that this set of talks between South Korea and North Korea will be an initial step. They have to, of course, agree to what kinds of conditions they will be able to agree to for North Korea to participate in the Olympics. For example, how many athletes will come, how many people from high-level officials will come, what types of cheering squads they will bring, things like that. And then, of course, there is some discussion perhaps that North Korea may try to talk with high-level South Korean leaders during the Olympics and perhaps even U.S. High-level delegation if one is coming. We understand that President Trump has announced that Vice President Mike Pence will probably be attending the 2018 Olympics, so there may be some attempts to try and discuss some more serious issues during North Korea's participation in the Olympics.
We're talking right now with Lisa Collins. She is a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. You can join this conversation about North and South Korea. What questions do you have about North and South Korea? What experience have you had in South Korea? Do you travel there? And what is it like? Join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Will you be going to the Winter Olympics next month? Do you have questions about South Korean culture, customs? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lisa, it seems almost any Olympics, there are defections that happen from countries. Do you anticipate this might happen at this Olympics with North Koreans coming to South Korea?
I think it would be really difficult. It's certainly possible, but it would be very hard, I think, because not only because of the attention that would be paid to the North Korean delegation that would be in South Korea, but also the North Koreans themselves will bring a lot of security with them because of the amount of athletes and other people who will be attending from North Korea. So I think it would be very, very difficult for somebody to plan that sort of elaborate defection during that time period and be able to escape, the eyes and ears of the security official, North Korean security forces, who will be probably, constantly with the athletes and the delegation at all times while they're in South Korea. Now, there was a defection of a North Korean soldier across the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, a few weeks ago, which drew international attention. And that's actually something that's also very difficult because of the amount of military force and, the security that's existing that exists on the border between North Korea and South Korea. But it's not impossible. So again, a defection during the Olympics could happen, but I don't foresee it probably happening.
Take us to the 38th parallel, if you will. Explain for us what it is and what it is like there along the border, military-wise.
Okay, so the two Koreas were divided in 1945 after the Second World War. Korea was occupied by Japan from 1905 through 1945 Second World War, and then when the Second World War ended, there was a division of the Korean Peninsula in the north and in the south. In the north, Soviet forces occupied the territory, and in the south, U.S. forces held ground with the United Nations. Through that period after the end of the Second World War, the U.S. set up a government in the south. And then there was a government also set up in the north by the Soviets. And then that's when the 38th parallel was drawn as a dividing line between the two Koreas. And then it sort of solidified after many years, after the temporary governments became formal official governments. In North Korea, 1948, I believe, was the time when they set up the official North Korean government. And then there were military barricades, fencing set up along the military demilitarized zone, and of course there were military forces that were stationed in that area. So it's been a continuous barrier between the two Koreas, and the most heavily fortified military barrier in the world.
Lisa Collins stays with us to explain the relationship along the 38th parallel. She's a fellow with Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and an expert on the Korean Peninsula. You can ask a question, 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts as you watch the escalation? What do you think about North Korea? Are you worried about what happens next? What confuses you about the tense relations? Join in or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll return after a news update. We're taking a closer look at the tense history between North and South Korea and how citizens on the Korean Peninsula cope with the political instability. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley explained the U.S.'s position on North Korea in an interview Sunday on ABC's This Week. She says she knows it makes people nervous when the president talks about nuclear weapons in North Korea, but she says President Trump needs to keep Kim Jong-un on his toes.
We're not going to let them go and dramatize the fact that they have a button right on their desk and that they can destroy America. We want to always remind them, we can destroy you too, so be very cautious and careful with your words and what you do.
Lisa Collins stays with us to understand the politics between North and South Korea. She is a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think North Korea's participation in the Olympics will improve its relations with South Korea and with the rest of the world? Will you be going to the Winter Olympics next month? 800-642-1234. Lisa, first of all, explain for us the size of the North Korea military, the size of the South Korean military, and the capabilities of each.
So the North Korean military has approximately 100 military personnel associated with it, and that includes ground soldiers and military officials. So it's a very, very large military. The South Korean.
Wait, you just said 100.
Sorry, 1 million.
1 million. There we go. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, sorry, 1 million military personnel. And the South Korean forces are much smaller. They have approximately, I believe, 300,000 military personnel included in their military. So it's a relatively smaller force in South Korea, but the technology that South Korea has is much more advanced than North Korea. North Korea has a lot of conventional military forces that are very old and rapidly degrading. And then, of course, it has its nuclear weapons program and ballistic missiles program. So there's a very large gap between the two Koreas. And then South Korean forces are supplemented by the U.S. forces, about 28,000 U.S. forces that are in South Korea stationed there at this time that help protect the country also from the North Korean threat.
And where are the U.S. bases?
U.S. bases are there's one in Osan, there's one close to the Incheon Airport, and then there are military forces stationed along the border around the DMZ, and then there's another military base in the south, sort of in the southeast.
Let's go to Steve, who joins us in Madison. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. As an expert, you're probably aware of both of strong efforts for reunification, both in North and South Korea, and the fact that those reunification agendas are suppressed on both sides of the border. And we're wondering whether that's done mainly on the part of U.S. influence, because U.S. influence would be removed from the peninsula if they did reunify. Would you like to speak at all to the loss of U.S. control, the threat to the United States that reunification of the two Koreas would represent?
Steve, thank you. Lisa, go ahead.
So So it really depends on what kind of unification you would be talking about. There are different scenarios for how unification might happen. Traditionally, we talk about three different kinds of scenarios. One would be war between the two Koreas that would eventually lead to unification. Another would be a South Korean-led unification, probably helped by United States forces, and that would be a democratic unification. The other type of unification would be a North Korean-led unification, probably by North Korea attacking South Korea and U.S. forces like they did when the Korean War started. And then another scenario, final scenario, would be a collapse of the North Korean regime and the government that would lead to intervention by regional countries such as the United States, China, perhaps Russia, Japan. So it really depends on what kind of unification you're talking about. In the scenario where unification happens through South Korean democratic-led unification, there would not be a removal of U.S. troops from the peninsula, particularly in the beginning. There might be an agreement later to remove United States troops, but that would be an agreement that would happen with all of the countries in the region being invested in that. And then with a war or a unification that was led by North Korea, the North Koreans would probably try to remove U.S. forces, but again, it would depend on the outcome of the entire war.
Steve, thanks so much for the call. Matt from Wausau emailed and said, if sanctions worked, North Korea wouldn't have nuclear weapons. Sanctions have led to the North Korean people being several inches smaller than their South Korean counterparts and generally less healthy. Matt says economic sanctions punish the average North Korean and again do nothing to stop their acquisition of weapons. It's time to try something other than the name calling that President Trump is fond of. How would you respond there?
So I don't actually believe that sanctions do lead to stunting of growth of average North Koreans. That's actually the work of the North Korean regime itself. If the North Korean regime were to use the money that it spends building up nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs and use that money to give to its people, give more food, give more daily necessities and supplies, that would actually fix the problem. The main concern of the United States and other countries in the region is that North Korea is not using that money that could go to its people to help them. It's actually using that money, the money it earns from different illicit activities around the world, to feed its nuclear weapons program and build up ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. So I do believe that sanctions can have an effect in helping to stop North Korea's nuclear weapons program development. It's not going to completely stop it, but I think it can slow it down and have an effect. It just takes some time, and I think the United States has been working on that over the last several years, and particularly over the last several months, to try and cut down the money, particularly the foreign currency that is being transferred or being collected and sent back to the North Korean government through different channels around the world. So I think it's something that we have to watch very closely. Of course, the United States does support humanitarian aid if it's needed and if it goes to the right people, which is our children and women who are pregnant or very vulnerable communities inside North Korea. The United States does not object to that. And South Korea also has been trying, the new government in South Korea, Moon Jae-in's government, has been trying to give some humanitarian aid to North Korea.
What do we know about what life is really like for people living in rural parts of North Korea and urban parts of North Korea? What is life like?
Life is very tough for North Koreans who are living in rural areas. They have to basically fend for themselves, and that is come up with food and basic necessities to stay alive because they're not provided any of those necessities from the North Korean regime. Because North Korean government and the entire country is run under a socialist and totalitarian system. Originally, the government was supposed to provide all of those things, food and basic necessities, to its people. But after the late 1990s, there was a very large famine in North Korea. I think because of the end of the Cold War, there was a breakdown in support from the Soviet Union and other communist countries. So there was a very large lack of food in North Korea, and the North Korean government was not able to provide for its people anymore and stopped sending them food. And so the North Koreans, what they did is they started to grow food on their own in small plots outside of their houses. They also started to trade along the border in greater amounts with Chinese. And then so there was a market system, an informal, illegal black market system that was initially started in the late 1990s and then later on developed into a more systematic market system that spread throughout the country that was sort of tacitly acknowledged and allowed to operate by the North Korean government that helped provide food and basic necessities to North Koreans. So that's how the majority of North Koreans survive nowadays, is basically through their own hard work and resistance and resilience.
Is that market system pretty robust right now today, still operating?
Yes. So there have been times when the North Korean government has tried to crack down on the market system because it posed a threat to the regime's control over the people. The crackdowns have not worked because the market system has become so prevalent and has become so embedded in North Korean society. And so markets have spread all across the country, even to the rural areas. Of course, in rural areas, there will not be large markets. They'll have to travel a little ways to larger urban areas or areas where they have more regular markets that are open. But they've spread across the country and now are located in all different provinces, and they provide all kinds of different goods. They provide goods that have been imported from China. They provide goods that have been produced locally, for example, shoes or basic clothing, toothpaste, things like that. And then they provide other types of basic goods that you would need for your survival.
And what kind of currency or monetary system are they using in this market system?
So the North Koreans have their own currency, which is the North Korean won. But most of the people who trade in these markets, they don't trade in the North Korean won because it's not worth very much money. What they actually trade in is foreign currency like Chinese renminbi or the U.S. dollar. Mm. So they're trading in that currency because they know if anything happens, if the North Korean government decides to do another crackdown and to redenominate the currency, they can turn to a stable form of money, which is the U.S. dollar or the Chinese currency as well.
Let's go to Zach, who has a question in Wapaka. Hi, Zach, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I think these talks are directly related to the inflammatory talk and complete disregard for the innocence of Donald J. Trump. I mean, I think he views nuclear war as a transactional type of endeavor, and North and South Korea both have a completely different stake in the game, more of a crisis of humanity. And so the fact that they're talking, it makes me a little bit unnerved because, you know, it's good that they're talking, but it's also a common enemy that they really have in Donald J. Trump.
Zach, thanks for the call. Lisa, a crisis of humanity.
So I agree that the fact that the two Koreas are talking is a relatively good thing. We do have to question why the North Koreans have agreed to talks at this point in time. Since the South Korean government, the new government, Moon Jae-in's government, has come to power a little more than 6 months ago, they have continuously proposed talks to North Korea, but North Korea has actually refused those proposals. It's only very recently that they've agreed to come back to a dialogue with South Koreans. I mean, there is some wariness in South Korea about President Trump and his unexpected and unpredictable behavior, but I don't think that is something that North Korea and South Korea would jointly unite on as a reason for, having a common enemy. North Korea is the common enemy of South Korea and the United States. There's no way that South Korea, an ally of the United States, would turn their back on a 60-plus year alliance relationship just because North Korea has suddenly agreed to come back to talks. And again, I think that there's a lot of progress that has to be made through the inter-Korean talks to even get to a point where they can agree to have meaningful dialogue about denuclearization, which would be a fundamental basic step that we need to happen for there to be long-term progress on the Korean Peninsula.
Lisa, are North Koreans forced to serve in the military, and do they get paid for it, their service?
Yes, they are forced to serve in the military. They have a 10-year service requirement for all men and women, and they don't get paid for it, and it's a fundamental requirement. In South Korea, there's also a mandatory military service requirement only for men, and they have to serve a little less than 2 years in the military. But North Koreans have a much longer service requirement.
And in terms of the population of North Korea, has it stayed stable over the decades? Is it decreasing? What do we know about its population?
North Korea's population decreased during the years of the famine in the late 1990s and early 2000s. There are different estimates about how many people died during that famine period. I think the high estimate is around 2 million. The lower estimate is around 500,000 people. So there have been some changes around that period in the North Korean population, but it's stayed relatively stable. And now I believe it's about 25 million people in total in North Korea, which is about half the size of the South Korean population, which is now close to 50 million people.
And along the border, along that 38th parallel, what do we know about how it is enforced? You can walk across the border, of course, at one's peril. So I would assume this is a heavily militarized border, or what is it like there at the border?
Yes, it's extremely militarized. It's very, very heavily guarded. There's barbed wire all along the entire fence line across the 38th parallel and the demilitarized zone. On the North Korean side, there are guards who have guard posts that with guns who are guarding the border. And South Koreans also have guard posts, and they do regular watches. They send their military troops to walk along the border and to guard the dividing line between the two Koreas.
North Korea announced this week that it will be sending an Olympic delegation to the upcoming Winter Olympics, but that presents logistical issues because the two countries are technically still at war. And we're talking about what's at stake with Lisa Collins, fellow and Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can join in with your questions about North and South Korea at 800-642-1234. Do you think North Korea's participation in the Olympics will improve its relations with South Korea and with the rest of the world? Are you going to the Olympics? Have you ever been deployed to South Korea? What is your connection to the Korean culture? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a check of the latest news. We're exploring why tensions run so high between North and South Korea and where the U.S. stands when it comes to urging North Korea to abandon its missiles. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson told CNN 1 week ago that tough military action against North Korea remains an option if diplomatic efforts fail.
The president has demonstrated to the world how high the stakes are. That's why we must achieve a diplomatic outcome. But the North Koreans have to understand that, and they have to understand that the penalties to them will continue and will only grow more severe in terms of sanctions actions and other actions until they do get on a pathway to achieve that objective that the entire world hopes to achieve.
Lisa Collins stays with us to piece together the patchwork of diplomacy. She is a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can add your voice to the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have insights to share on North and South Korea? Have you traveled to South Korea? Would you consider going to a city like Seoul? 800-642-1234. Lisa, you were living in South Korea for a decade, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What was life like there in South Korea for your decade?
So I had a very good experience living in South Korea. It's a very dynamic society, and it's constantly changing. There are lots of modern conveniences in South Korea, and the people tend to be very, very friendly and open once you get to know them. The city of Seoul itself is a very, very modern city. It rivals places like Tokyo and New York City. There are constantly buildings going up, lots of companies trying to do productive work there. We know South Korea as the producer of a lot of our semiconductor chips that go into our cell phones. We know them from the famous corporations like Samsung and Hyundai, who makes cars. And it's a dynamic and growing country.
And Seoul is a huge, huge city.
Yeah, Seoul itself and the metropolitan area that encompasses Seoul, it has about 15 million people living there. So it's a very large, but large place.
Let's go to Brad, who joins us from Jefferson now. Hi, Brad.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My opinion is that we should have the rules, the same rules for everyone, equality under the law, and that no one should have nuclear weapons. Especially the United States, who's the only nation who's ever used it on another nation, on human beings. I'd also like to say that North Korean people are not my enemy. And if anybody wants to learn more, go to veteransforpeace.org.
Brad, thanks for the call. Lisa, go ahead.
So I would say, first of all, that nobody believes the North Korean people are the enemy themselves. The North Korean people, as I mentioned a little earlier in the show, are actually trying to live their lives the best that they can and resist and survive the decisions that are made by the North Korean regime, which is a totalitarian government. The government is one thing, and we can say the United States is encouraging the North Korean government to give up its nuclear weapons, but the North Korean people themselves, they are some of the strongest people you would probably ever know on the face of the planet. I have talked with North Korean defectors who have come from North Korea. They have amazing stories of survival and resistance coming out of the country. And so I think there's no question about that. Whether or not the United States should give up its nuclear weapons, that's not a question that I think I can address. I'm not inside the U.S. government, and I don't deal with nuclear weapons policy.
Let's go to Stefan in Madison. Hi, Stefan.
Hi there. I was going to share the story. My wife and I adopted two boys from Korea in 2008 and 2010. And so we were able to travel actually three times and visit and learn a lot about Korea and the culture. And something that people who have adopted from Korea really believe in continuing that culture and that story. Here in Madison, we actually have a group of families through Korean adoption that we get together and bring students from Madison, international students, or also adoptees to share their stories about Korean culture, food, dance, music, other things. One of the things that I was, quick story, really impressed with when we were adopting, we had the opportunity to meet with Dr. Kim. I forget the other part of his name, but he was actually the founder of Eastern Welfare Society, EWSA, which was a organization set up after the Korean War to do Korean, international Korean adoptions. And he was about 90 years old when we met him in 2008. And I spent about 90 minutes, hour and a half with him. And he talked about his story. And then he spent about 15 minutes repeating his thanks and appreciation for the United States coming into Korea to help free South Korea or fight for South Korea, for him to have this great opportunity. So that was just something I wanted to share.
Stefan, thank you so much for sharing your story. Lisa, what about the international Korean adoptions? There are a number of adoptions also?
So, yes, throughout South Korea's modern history over the last 60 years or so, there have been international adoptions of children from South Korea to the United States and other countries around the world. I have many friends who are adoptees originally from South Korea who now live in the United States and in Europe, and they have very good and complex experiences, and a lot of them are very thankful of the ability to have been adopted by loving and caring families around the world. And, you know, South Korea, a lot of the adoptions happened when South Korea was a relatively poor society and had a very weak economy in the 1970s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then things changed afterwards when South Korea basically took off in its economic growth. And so there are many, many fewer international adoptions that happen today, but the majority of them happened a little over 30 years ago. But it's a very complex dynamic that had a lot to do with, you know, the state of the South Korean economy and society in the period of time when it was still developing.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the family reunions that happen between North and South Koreans?
So family reunions are also sadly tied to the complex history of the division of the Korean Peninsula and the ongoing tension and whatnot that goes on between North and South Korea. Once the Korean Peninsula was divided after 1945, North Korea did not allow any of its citizens to travel south, and vice versa. South Korea also did not allow anybody to travel north. So the families that were split by the war and the later division and occupation of the peninsula were not allowed to see each other. And it's been more than 60 years since some of these families have had contact with each other. What happens occasionally is North Korea and South Korea, they agree to have a family reunion, which is usually held in a location in North Korea called Kumgang Mountain. It's a resort where they have the families come together. The families are selected based on a agreement between the North and South. In North Korea, you have to have special government government acceptance and agreement to have family members come to the meetings. And in South Korea, it's basically done by a lottery system. They put all of the names of the families on a list, and they choose them when the time comes. And so the family reunions happen in this one location, and approximately 100 family members from each side are allowed to participate in the meetings. And they're very emotional, as you can imagine, because people have not seen each other, their loved ones, for over 60 years. And so it's a very tough time, but it's also, I think, a time that the families really believe is a precious opportunity. Some of them meet once and never meet again, and they are not able to have any contact because of the circumstances between the two Koreas. So they may see their family member once and then pass away without having any further contact. And many of the family members are in their late 70s, 80s, even 90s. So they're very, they're growing very old very quickly, and the opportunities for the families to meet again, the opportunities are not very, are very, very few and far between. It's a very sad circumstance.
Do you think family reunions will continue to be held in the future for younger generations of Koreans?
It's hard to say. It really all depends on North Korea, to be honest. South Korea proposes these family reunions relatively often to North Korea, and North Korea rarely agrees to them unless it has a political objective or motive for having the meetings. When the older family members die off, there's, I think, less chance of having younger family members meet because there's not that emotional tie anymore or connection as there would be between family members who actually grew up with each other or lived together for several years before they were divided and split apart. But North Korea and South Korea, the family reunions are very important to both sides, I believe, and they could continue if the circumstances are right in the future.
Lisa, as we begin to wrap up, what are you watching for as the Olympics unfold next month? What are some things that we might expect? What are you watching for?
So I think the things to watch for are what comes out of the agreement between the meetings between North and South Korea in the next few weeks leading up to the Olympics. They will agree on how many athletes will come from North Korea, how many high-level officials will come, and then who is going to be in the delegation of high-level officials coming from North Korea will be very important, because I think that will either signal North Korea's willingness to engage in more dialogue, or it may signal the opposite, that North Korea is going to continue to take a hardline stance against the United States and South Korea and continue to develop its nuclear weapons.
Lisa, thank you so much for your time.
Sure.
Lisa Collins is a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and she's an expert on the Korean Peninsula. This Hour of the Morning Show was produced by Colleen Leahy, Keely Baltina, and Nyasia Ellison. Brittany Williams provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.